Okay, so now it's my privilege to introduce two gentlemen named Gene. Our own Gene Lozano will be introducing Reverend Dr. Gene Borken, who is joining us from Thailand. It's almost like speaking to a foreign correspondent. So it's kind of fun to do this. Dr. Borken's going to talk to us about pedestrian control over drivers yielding. And I just want to say that the thought of having a gentleman who's both a reverend and a mobility instructor with me when I cross a really busy street is very reassuring. So where Gene Lozano is concerned, I had the pleasure and privilege to work with Gene around 2007, 2008 on the initial San Francisco Audible Pedestrian Signals project that we did through structured negotiations with the city of San Francisco. And I learned a great deal from that. I want to report to Gene that there is now a signal at Onondaga and Mission, yay. And there's one at my corner, Seneca and Mission, because they built a new apartment building on my block. So without further sidelighting, I will turn it over to my friend Gene Lozano.
Thank you very much, Linda, and I appreciate the update. Always like to hear progress. On behalf of the CCB, I wish to welcome you to the second part of a two-series presentation regarding the pedestrian safety matters. Our first presentation occurred on April 11th, which looked at how to assess and cross streets with no stop sign or traffic signals. Today, as has been touched upon, we will be looking at how to affect drivers' yielding behavior. I'm really honored to introduce our presenter, Reverend Dr. Eugene Borken, who is, as Linda stated, is coming from Thailand, where it is the early morning of Sunday, April 25th. I believe it's approximately a little after 3 a.m. there. Dr. Borken is a native New Yorker who is a well-known international and national lecturer on topics related to driver yielding behavior, sign interpretation, the mobility of people who are blind or deaf blind. Additionally, he has participated in several groundbreaking orientation and mobility research studies, including the need for accessible pedestrian signals at intersections in New York City, which are equipped with leading pedestrian intervals. Some of his work that he has done will be covered this afternoon regarding driving, affecting drivers' yielding behavior. Dr. Borken has a very diverse education and employment background. He has a doctoral degree in health administration from the University of Phoenix, a master's in deafness rehabilitation from New York University, and has multiple certifications such as orientation mobility specialist, low vision therapist, American Sign Language and English interpreter. His employment has covered a variety of different jobs that he has held over the many decades, and to show how diverse his employment has been, for the first 21 years, he was a systems programmer for IBM mainframe computers. He's been an interpreter for the deaf, and then he's worked in the capacity as O&M specialist, where he's still doing, and low vision therapist. Dr. Borkum's depth of knowledge and expertise on matters pertaining to the blind, the deaf, and the deaf-blind have come out of his employment in a variety of different settings. I will not go through all of them, but just to give you a sampling, the sign interpreter program at College of Staten Island, the National Center on Deafblindness in suburban New York, the Lexington School for the Deaf in New York City, and more recently as pastoral minister for people who are blind or deaf in the Diocese of New York City at the Church of, Episcopal Church, and I apologize. So with no further delay, I wish to turn this virtual room over to Dr. Borkum, and let's give him a virtual hand of applause. Thank you.
Oh, I can hear that applause. It's really quite deafening. Good morning, everybody. Good morning from Chiang Mai, Thailand, where it is indeed 10 minutes after 3. Well, I think that that kind introduction was so lengthy that maybe we've run out of time. We should just wrap it up and do another door prize. But I guess I have to say something, so I'm going to begin my presentation. I'm going to put a PowerPoint up on the screen. The PowerPoint is more for me than anybody else because it will guide me to and remind me what to say and not to say. If anybody would like an accessible version of this PowerPoint after the presentation, you can contact me by on my email, which I think CCB has, and I'll be happy to pass it on to you. For now, I just wanted to, first of all, I wanted to ask, how are we taking questions, Linda or Jean? How will I know somebody has a question, or should I just be pausing and letting people speak up? Or is there somebody who will moderate questions as we go through?
Hi, this is Belinda. I'm going to be your host, and I will let you know if you have raised hands.
Terrific. So I encourage me being interrupted as often as you need. Okay, so let's get to it. This presentation is a concise, abbreviated session that usually takes about 3 hours or more to give. And it comes in two parts. So I'll just lay out the roadmap we're going to follow. The first part, I'll be talking about drivers yielding and what those environmental, built-in environmental things impact, whether a driver is likely to yield or not. And the second thing, the media part, the meatier part of this presentation, is the part that talks about how we as people with vision loss or people who are blind can actually control drivers, and to what degree we can control drivers. It wasn't said in the introduction, but I will note that I am a person living with glaucoma, and I have a serious vision loss. And I also have a hearing loss and typically wear hearing aids unless I'm wearing headphones that I'm wearing right now. So this work, this was a series of 6 or 7 research studies that we're putting together here that we'll present in part 2. So let me, there we go. I wanted to first explain why I think this topic is so important for everyone. Let me just do that. And a couple of months back, we had an orientation mobility seminar, webinar, conference. There were several hundred people there, and we polled the people who were at the conference. These were mostly, almost all, orientation and mobility specialists. And we looked at their knowledge of what we're calling driver's yielding. Driver's yielding means that when you are about to or are already sharing a space in a crosswalk, how likely is the driver to slow down enough that you can cross safely or stop completely? So that's what I mean when I say a driver's yield. So we looked at this couple of hundred O&M specialists, and we found out that 52% of them had not been taught anything about advanced driver yielding techniques. 24% had actually touched on the topic in their graduate education, meaning 76% had not. 47% of these professionals had not taught advanced yielding techniques at all. And about 34% had indeed taught some of the techniques we'll talk about today. In a survey of knowledge, 1% responded correctly about driver yielding at roundabouts. That means that 99% of the mobility specialists who we queried actually didn't know what the situation was at roundabouts for blind and low vision travelers. 2% responded correctly about drivers yielding and displaying a cane at a crosswalk. 87% answered incorrectly when we talked about the impact of head turning and eye contact with drivers. And 53% answered incorrectly when we talked about tools to make drivers yield more often. That is things like wearing a vest or waving a bright orange flag. The answers to these questions are not apparent. They're not obvious. So we'll share them with you today. They are not even apparent or obvious to O&M professionals who teach people every day how to travel independently and how to travel safely. So let me share some statistics. Over the past several decades, every year there's about 4,000 or 5,000 pedestrians who are killed by drivers and by vehicles. Recently, in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, we've seen an uptick in that. So there's been a substantial increase in the number of people who are getting injured or killed by drivers. And the number one cohort in that driver category are drivers who are turning into the crosswalk that you may want to cross through. In 2019, there were almost 7,000 people killed in vehicle pedestrian crashes. And more than 75,000 people were injured at a crosswalk. So those are some pretty shocking numbers. We do not have reliable numbers that apply just to people with vision loss. So the best I can do is give you those general ideas. I wanted to quote an article that was written a little while ago. It said, pedestrians must be able to analyze the level of risk in order to make decisions, assess the level of risk can include determining the likelihood that drivers will yield to a pedestrian crossing a street. To some extent, all pedestrians depend on yielding behavior of drivers, whether by intention or circumstance, and regardless of laws and regulations. Basically, what that means is everybody injured and everybody killed by a driver and the vehicle is because the driver didn't stop. There is no other explanation for that. The driver should have stopped because a pedestrian was present but didn't. And those numbers are concerning. So I'm going to go through quickly the factors that are involved in the environment that we cannot control for the most part. We can make decisions about where to cross, but we don't have a lot of impact on whether the driver is going to yield or not. The driver is under the control of the environment, in other words. The first thing I would mention is weather and lighting. A 2013 study indicated that for every 100% increase in street illumination, the likelihood for a driver to yield would increase by 4.5%. That would mean if you doubled or tripled the light on a street at a place you want to cross, the percent of drivers yielding would go up by 9% or more. So that's a really interesting statistic. I think everybody here is active in the field in one way or another. As advocates, we want to advocate for some of these things. In another study done in Canada, 15% of all incidents occurred on wet roads or when it was raining. And keep in mind that 15% of travel by vehicles and by people does not account for that. That's a very high statistic. So the impact of weather and lighting is very great. Traffic signals, or what are commonly called traffic lights, are the best thing that controls drivers. Drivers adhere to a red light or a red signal more than any other traffic control that we have. And so we are safest when we're at a traffic signal. That said, if in an area there are too many traffic signals or too many stop signs, we know that drivers become less compliant the more often they have to stop. So if you have a choice of crossing where there is a stop sign or a traffic signal, the traffic signal is going to get you much higher yielding rates. In one study done, they looked at 5 busy intersections over a 5-month period, and only one motorist ran a red light in 20 minutes at each intersection. So the rate of compliance is very high for drivers yielding. The second highest impact on drivers yielding is the speed at which the driver is going, the miles per hour or kilometers per hour that occurs in any given environment. Just one statistic here, pedestrians have a 90% survival of a crash at 30 kilometers per hour, but only a 50% chance of survival at higher speeds. And if you were looking at my slides right now, you would see 3 different charts. And each of these charts, I'll summarize, each of these charts shows that as the driver's speed goes up, the yielding rate to pedestrians goes down. For example, at 10 miles per hour, drivers yielded to a pedestrian about 80% of the time when there wasn't a traffic light. And when the speed went up to 25 miles per hour, the yielding went down to about 50%. When speeds go up even higher, greater than 50%, yielding goes way down to about 40%. So speed is the largest factor in us assessing the amount of risk we have when we're at a particular crossing. Another factor is driver expectation. If you are crossing where drivers expect you to be crossing, then you can be more assured that drivers will yield to you. If you're crossing in a place where drivers don't expect you, for example, outside a crosswalk or at a mid-block crossing, the drivers are less likely to yield to you. We also know that if you're crossing alone, your risk goes up, rather than if you're crossing with what traffic engineers would call a platoon, that's two or three or more pedestrians all crossing at the same time. And so when you can, you do want to cross in places where there are a lot of pedestrians. I'm going to give you some statistics about yielding when there aren't traffic controls, just so you have an idea of how often drivers have been found to stop for pedestrians. And this is a pedestrian who is in a ready position, who's standing at the edge of a curb or edge of a curb cut, and they're about to cross the street. So they're at a crosswalk of some type, and drivers are supposed to be yielding. In standard street geometry, they did a study on a campus. That's usually a pretty safe environment. About 80% of the drivers yielded. But when they looked at a crossing in a downtown intersection where there was no traffic lights or traffic controls, only 5% of the drivers yielded for a pedestrian who was waiting or about to cross. At a T intersection or a three-legged intersection, those numbers depend on where you are in the T, and that if you happen to be crossing the stem of the T, that is like the bottom of the T intersection, you get yielding at about 43%. At the top of the T, the yielding goes up to about 90%. So the geometry has a lot to do with this. Interesting, and I know that Jean and Sarah and Linda all brought this up to me. They wanted to talk a bit about roundabouts, and we will get to that, I promise. Yielding at the entry lanes where drivers are moving slower is about 30%, but at the exit lanes in some of the studies, yielding was as low as 5%. That is 19 out of 20 drivers do not stop for a pedestrian waiting to cross the crosswalk at a roundabout exit. And that can be a real problem if you live in a place. There's also a factor called curb radius. We all know that some corners are very tight. The curvature of the corner is very small. For example, in New York City, a lot of the corners are very tight and small. And in some suburban areas or rural areas, you have these big, long, curved corners. And that has a real impact on how often drivers yield. The bigger the radius, in other words, the bigger that curve that it goes around that corner, the longer it takes to cross that street and the less likely drivers are to yield. So if you are... And finally, of the factors that we have very little control over, and this is shocking because you may think to yourself, well, why are we talking about drivers yielding? You know, I go to the corner and what's ever there is there, and it just happens. But they did a study on racial bias and driver yielding, and they looked at Black pedestrians, they looked at white pedestrians. And when they looked at the first car that was supposed to yield to the pedestrian, white people got about 8% more yielding than Black people. when they looked at whether the second or third or fourth car yielded to the pedestrian, white people got twice as much yielding as black people. So that, I guess, is one of the quintessential uncontrollable factors. We can't very well control our race or ethnicity. And yet it has this huge impact on drivers and how they behave. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to ask if there are any questions that people might have at all about any of those factors, and or perhaps an experience somebody has had. If anybody wants to share anything, please do raise your hand and let me know.
Okay, we got a couple raised hands. Let's see here. Charlene, you should be able to unmute.
Thank you. Has there been any study of yielding to pedestrians with a white cane or a guide dog or no assistance? And I'm also curious, would it be legal to use a whistle to get drivers' attention?
Would it be legal to, I missed those final words.
Use a whistle, like a referee whistle or some kind of whistle, to get drivers' attention before you try to cross?
I don't know the legality in every state, because a lot of driving laws are state mandated and not federal. I don't know how effective that would be. That might be effective with cyclists, but with vehicles and closed windows and engine noise, that might not be effective. But we haven't studied whistles. We have definitely studied canes. We have definitely studied other things like waving a flag and stuff. And all of that's going to come in part two, where I think you'll find some interesting results about what works and what doesn't work. So it's a really good question. And the answer is a resounding yes. And I'm going to be sharing some of that information with you shortly. Is there another question?
Let's see, we have area code 909 ending in 497. You should be able to unmute. Okay, we're not hearing them. Let's see.
Hello. My name is Kathy, and I would like to know, has there been any research on cars yielding when turning left? So you'll have, sometimes there can be the light is green for the car to turn left, but the pedestrian walk sign is on for crossing. Has there been studies done on that versus the turning right on the green or red?
That's a good question. There have been general studies done on turning left, and I don't have those statistics in my head, so I'm going to have to beg off on giving you an exact answer. Most of the studies we're going to talk about today are the drivers turning right. And I would point out, prompted by your question, is that the car's ability to share your crosswalk is nearly always when you have a walk signal and the driver has a green signal. So that's almost always true. There is right turn on red, but if it's right turn on red, you do not have the walk signal. And there are sometimes what's called a protected turn or an arrow turn. And that would be the only time you would not have the walk signal, but the vehicles were turning left. So it's a complicated picture. But most of the studies I'm going to talk to you about today are right turn on red. I think we might extrapolate the techniques we're talking about to be used halfway in the crossing. We're going to talk about techniques that actually cause drivers to stop. And those techniques might be, we don't have exact studies, but you might think of using these techniques as you approach the middle of the crosswalk, and those cars turning left are about to share the crosswalk with you. But 95% of the time, you're going into the crosswalk, you have the signal, and at the same time, the driver has the signal that allows them to go into the crosswalk. Hope that answered it. I think I'm going to go on here now, and unless there's any burning desire, do we have more hands up?
Yes, we do. We have a couple.
I'd like to see if anybody has an important question, then keep your hand up. If you think you can wait until we go to part two and we talk about what we can control, then perhaps you want to put your hand down. But let's take one more question.
Okay, let's see. Sheila, you should be able to unmute.
Did I get it?
Yes, you did.
Yep.
Okay. So I live on a busy street with a weird intersection that has a yellow lights or flashing thingy that you have to hit the buttons to get. And the weird about it is there's the big street and there's the side street is divided in half. That street, it's not a four-way intersection all at once. It's the street is, I guess they call it offset. Is that number one? My first question is, number one, is that a three-legged intersection? And number two, I know that I often have to, even after hitting the button and waiting to see if anything slows down or stops, I have to always be watchful and mindful of what the cars are doing, because that's not a real light.
That's right.
We asked for a light and they put that in, and I don't even know why they bothered. It's almost worse because I don't know.
It's not accessible, right? It's not accessible. In other
words,
it
says yellow lights are flashing and it beeps to help you find the pole, but I didn't even know. When it first came in, I thought it was a real light. And when it said yellow lights are flashing, I kept waiting to hear a beep, 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 beep to go. Or a something. Message. I didn't know what yellow lights are flashing even freaking meant.
Yeah. That's a much more easily maintained intersection. You had the right words with offset. That is offset. And I'm going to discuss, when we move on to part two, things that should make you lower the risk. I don't like to use the word safe. No crossing is ever safe if you're sharing a space with a vehicle, but I sometimes use the word safer, or I talk about reducing risk. I think you should maybe think about the techniques we're going to talk about and see if you feel they'll fit that particular geometry, that particular signaling. It's not a great solution to traffic control, because yellow lights are just warning lights. If it were a blinking red light, it would be the equivalent of a stop sign. But a blinking yellow light is just a warning. And it's much less than the compliance you would get with what the traffic engineers call a red ball. I know that wasn't the most satisfying answer, but it's probably the best I can do in the abstract. I'm going to move on now to the second part of this. And in fact, so I can see what's going on here on the screen. I'm not even going to share my PowerPoint. I'm just going to refer to my PowerPoint, which I have in front of me on my iPad. If somebody really wants the PowerPoint displayed, if somebody is accessing it visually, I'd be happy to put it up. If anybody really wants it up, then...
Yeah, there are people who can watch the PowerPoint for sure.
In that case, I will be sharing the PowerPoint.
Thank you, Deb. You unmuted faster than I did. Thank you, Jean.
or whatever works for best for everybody. Okay. Sometimes I'm going to start with some things that we think will control drivers and making them stop that have virtually no effect at all. And one of those things is what's called warning area signage. You might be familiar with this. You might see a sign up in an area. Somebody may say to you, oh, we're driving by a sign. It says blind child area. Or it could say deaf child area. Or it could say something similar to that. You know, blind pedestrian crossing or something like that. And we may have a sense that this is going to help. I can tell you this. There isn't a traffic engineer in the country that would recommend those signs to any parent or any pedestrian. They have zero impact in study after study on the speed of drivers in an area or the crash rates in areas. So we know empirically that they don't have any effect. My colleague, Donna, who was the person who presented to the conference earlier in April, she and I put together a study, and we looked at, she had a friend who was deafblind, who said, oh, you know, I asked the traffic department to put up these signs at the crosswalks that say deafblind pedestrians with a big yield sign. And it said deafblind pedestrians, yellow signs with black writing, very clear. And she said, yes, I feel so much safer now. The drivers are stopping for me when I want to cross the street. And Donna and I said, okay. And we did a study. And we looked at two virtually identical pieces of roadway, sections of roadway, one which had these signs up and one which had no signs up. And we found absolutely no difference in the amount of driver yielding by any measure. In fact, in raw numbers, drivers yielded more to the deafblind pedestrian when the signs weren't present, when it didn't say deafblind pedestrians, when it did. So one of the riskiest things you can do is think that something is making it safer for you when it really isn't. So if you, as I think Sheila said earlier, if you need to cross the street, you should advocate for traffic signals, and we should advocate for accessible pedestrian signals at those traffic signals if we want to cross safely and have equal access to that crosswalk. So moving past that, I want to talk briefly about the phenomena that were the basis of these five or six or seven research projects. I think a lot of times we have an emotional reaction to drivers not stopping, and that's natural, of course. Who wouldn't? If you nearly get hit, or if a driver speeds by when you think you have the right of way, it's natural to get mad at drivers. But it's not very productive, because the reasons why drivers don't yield has more to do with what psychologists call the human visual cognition system. And that is how your brain processes visual information. I'll just go through some major reasons why drivers don't stop. Drivers who are intoxicated, that's the cause for drivers not yielding about 30 to 35% of the time. Drivers who are distracted account for a little bit more, about 35 to 40% of drivers who don't yield. Vehicle malfunction is really nothing. Those are the top two reasons. Only a very tiny percent of drivers ever get charged or given a ticket unless they are legally intoxicated. So that leaves a big gap to say, why do drivers not yield? And the reason drivers don't yield most of the time, according to the science and according to the studies, is that they don't see you. That's the simple explanation. They don't see you, and they don't know to stop. And that's not a very satisfying explanation, but it is the limitations of our own cognitive systems, our own brain. Because although we may envision that sighted people have a video recorder in their head and it sees everything, and they are able to respond to everything, that's simply not the truth. The leading cause of pedestrians being hit is the driver does not see them. In order for drivers to see pedestrians, what the brain has to do is has to first notice them, and second, they have to process that information deeply enough in the cognitive process to understand the intention of the driver. So most of this research is based on noticing and processing interpretation of what the person standing there, what their intention is. And in the case of a pedestrian wanting to cross the street, we want the driver to notice the pedestrian at the edge of the crosswalk, at the beginning of the crosswalk, and we want the driver to understand that they're about to cross that street. If we can do those two things, we have a very good chance of not being assaulted by a Toyota. So Tom Vanderbilt, and I recommend this book to many people. If you can get a hold of this book on driving by Tom Vanderbilt, I think it's How We Drive. And it talks about the science behind driving. And what Tom Vanderbilt says is that driving is automatic and it's mostly unconscious. Driving, for the most part, is what psychologists call an overlearned activity. It is something we're so well practiced at that we're able to do without much conscious thought. Most drivers in most situations can't consider everything in a conscious way and make decisions. The decisions are being made unconsciously because conscious thought is very slow when it comes to things like driving. There's also some social theories. People yield more often to people they think they should yield to. Women with baby carriages get yielding more often than men with shopping carts. And you can discuss the ethics of that, the morality of that. Why should a man with a shopping cart get killed more often than a woman with a baby carriage? But that's how we react in our because of the social conditioning we have. And they also do yield more often to people with perceived disabilities or people who are blind. Whether they yield enough is another question altogether. So a lot of drivers, including me when I was driving, have this reaction when they have a near miss or when they hit somebody. And that reaction is, I never saw her or I never saw him. It's not an uncommon reaction. And it's because the human cognition system has only so much capacity, what we might think of as bandwidth, to attend and become aware of information in its viewscape. A driver has a billion pieces of detail in front of them. And what they pay attention to is what they've been conditioned to pay attention to. And our ability to attend and notice is selective, and we can only select subsets of information for further processing. So these are the limitations that we live with. They are both real and documented. And so screaming at that driver when he passes you by and nearly hits you is emotionally satisfying, but probably not going to help that driver yield to you more the next time you encounter he or she. So what do drivers notice? Drivers notice things that are what's called in their attention set. That is a stimulus that automatically takes the driver's attention away from one thing and involuntarily puts it on another. It's called attentional capture. And that's what we want to do with the driver. We want to capture their attention. We want a certain amount of their bandwidth to know that we're standing there and that we want to cross. And I'm going to go through some of this a little more quickly because we are really coming up on time. The other thing is a thing called inattentional blindness, which means drivers can miss things that are right in front of them. Hope you could all hear that gorilla. There was a famous experiment where people were asked to pass a soccer ball around in a circle. And in the middle of that activity, they were supposed to track this white soccer ball. A person in a gorilla uniform comes out and walks right through the circle. And something like 40 to 50% of the people never see the gorilla. People do not see everything that is present in their vision. So we want to create conditions where we have attentional capture that's very high and that things that are in a person's attention set, so it has meaning, and we want inattentional blindness to be low. So let's look at these studies on crossing. The first thing we looked at, or one of the first things we looked at, was cane color. So now we're talking about people crossing a street and what color cane they're going to use. And we compared a standard white mobility cane with a red stripe at the bottom to a black mobility cane, a yellow mobility cane, and a green mobility cane. And if I asked you to which one got the most yielding, I bet most of you would get the answer right. It would be a white cane. Let me share the statistics. When we did this study, white canes got 68% of yielding in the situations we set up for this test. The black cane got 50%. Good for Yahoo, that movie with the guy who had the black cane. What was it called? Scent of a Woman. The yellow cane got 31% yielding, and the green cane got 18% yielding. So that is 50% less yielding from drivers, depending on your cane color. Now, if you want to go to if you have a kid and he wants to go to his prom, you might want to use a black cane. Or, you know, you want to go to a garden party, you might want to use a green cane. And I'm certainly not going to tell you what cane to use. That's completely up to you. But if you want the most yielding, you're going to be choosing a standard white cane in order to cross the street. And I'm flashing on the screen some bar charts which show the white cane with that 50% more yielding than the green cane. The next slide I have up here is people and where people waiting to cross. And in this case, there's no cane, but there are three pictures. In one picture, the pedestrian is standing 1 foot back from the curb. In the next picture, the person is standing at the edge of the curb. And in the third picture, the person is standing a foot into the street. And the amount of yielding goes up with each of those conditions. This person standing back from the curb is getting 45% yielding. The person standing at the curb is getting 53% yielding. And the person standing in the street is 60% yielding. I don't mean to imply that you should stand in the street when you wait to cross, but I am implying that maybe standing 3 or 4 feet back from the curb is not a good idea. And you'll see how we use this early study, which happened, I think, back in the early 2000s, on techniques that will help you increase driver yielding and reducing your risk. I've got a picture here. And what we did was we looked at the impact of turning your head towards the driver or gazing at the driver as if you could see them and making eye contact. And I'll go very quickly through this research because what we found is it didn't really matter at all. If you turn your head back to look at the driver, or you turn your head back to stare at the driver, or if you turn your head back right at the point when you're going to step off the curb, none of those things had any substantial impact on whether the driver would yield to you or not. So if you're using some vision and you want to keep your vision on the walk signal, waiting for that signal to come on, Or if you want to monitor the traffic behind you to your left or ahead of you to your left when you're crossing, say, counterclockwise, you can do that and it won't matter to the driver. They're not likely to yield more often than if you didn't do that. And I'm going to do this next study and then I'm going to pause for some questions. In the next study, we tested some of the things we had heard people were using in the field. And those were things like wearing a bright orange reflective vest or waving a bright orange flag, waving it prominently out there in front of you when you want to cross the street. And we did 375 trials. And in 375 plus crossings, I stood at a crosswalk. And when it was timed for the car to be right in front of me, that is, when I stepped out, I was timed that that car would hit me directly if the car didn't slow down or stop. So I did that about 400 times. It's not a very pleasant thing to do. But we looked at the behavior of the drivers. So to make this clear again, in all of these trials, I was walking out into the street on an intersecting path with a car going anywhere from like 20 to 50 miles per hour, coming directly at me. The driver didn't know that I was going to stop before I entered the second half of the roadway where the oncoming car was coming. And we did that, and we don't know how we got away with that with the human subject safety protocols at universities, but we got to do it. And this is what we found with with a cane, we found out that we got a very high yielding rate of about 90%. With a cane wave, a wave in the air. No, this is not the study I wanted to show you. Oh, here we go. Okay. This is the first results. The pedestrian, myself, had no cane at all. And the general yielding rate was about 40%. When we used the flag, a bright orange flag waving in front of us, the yielding went up to about 60%. And when we wore a bright orange reflective vest, the yielding was about 50%. What I can tell you is that those three numbers have no statistically significant difference. The difference could be due to chance. There was no statistical difference between walking into the street in plain clothing or walking into the street waving a flag or walking into the street with a bright orange vest on. And so those tools were not seen to be very helpful. There was a little bump in yielding, but nothing that was statistically more significant than just walking out there into the street. Moving on, I wanted to show the results of with a cane. And with a cane, basically, we got very high yielding rates. Remember, I was walking directly on a path to be in front of that car. We got high yielding rates. No matter if we waved a cane or waved a flag or wore a vest, the yielding rates were close to 90%. So that's a kind of interesting study that said, if you want to cross at a place and you think you're going to be more safe by waving a flag or wearing a vest, the chances are that you might be a tiny bit more safe, but not statistically more safe. The next study we did was looking at different conditions with drivers yielding to a pedestrian who is standing at the crosswalk. The situation is that the driver is behind me on my left. I'm standing at the crosswalk. I'm about to cross in the crosswalk that the driver can turn into, making a right turn into the crosswalk when they get the green signal. So I was waiting there to cross. The driver got the green signal. I got the walk signal. And we tested a bunch of conditions. And let me explain those conditions quickly. In the first condition, I stood there holding my cane out, displayed in the direction of the turning traffic, prominently out in front of me. So what I was doing was what we call a cane display. And that's sort of the standard thing they teach you to teach in mobility school. It might be the thing that you were taught to do when you were learning to cross the street, is to wait for the near lane parallel surge. And while you're waiting, just put that cane out there so the driver can see it, so that the driver knows what you want to do. Driver will notice you and they will yield. The other conditions we tested was a cane flag, which was picking the cane up to about waist level and tapping it right and left, tapping it twice. So bringing the cane across my body twice. The third condition was displaying the cane and holding my hand up into the air towards the traffic in sort of a signal saying stop. And the last thing is a condition we call the reversible step. And the reversible step is a technique that when you get the walk signal, you take one safe step into the street and you flag the cane in front of you, and then you pause, and then if you check for the driver yielding, and if the driver is yielding or there is no driver, you cross the street, you go ahead. So again, the reversible step is you wait for the signal to cross. At that signal, You wave your cane out into the street and flag it as you take one safe and reversible step into the street. And we're going to look at those results and what we found with those conditions. We also did a condition called a control, which meant that the pedestrian was just standing there with no cane and no technique. The first thing we found, which was really interesting, I think, is that having a cane or not displayed made almost no difference at all, nearly no difference. Driver, if you just stood there without a cane, drivers yielded about 33% of the time. If you stood there with a cane, drivers yielded about 44% of the time. Those two numbers are not statistically different. If you stood there and when you had got the signal to cross, you flagged your cane back and forth twice, driver yielding went up to 64%. That's a big jump, a significant amount of yielding, but still not statistically different than a cane display. The two techniques that work the greatest to cause yielding by a turning vehicle were the hand up, which was 74% yielding. If you put your hand up as you went to cross, you put your hand up towards the driver, and if you did the reversible step, yielding went up to 91%. That's 91% from a low of 33% or 44% if you had a cane in your hand. I'm going to pause there and ask if there were questions, because this was the first big substantial study that we did in a very realistic situation. Can I ask if there are any hands up at this point, or if I can explain anything?
We have three raised hands. Well, one more. Let's see.
Let's take two questions, and then I'll go through the rest of the studies, okay, and we can take final questions.
So area code 951, you can unmute.
Hi, my name is Christine Bailey. I like your presentation. I have a question for you. If you are on a sidewalk and you're crossing a driveway, who has the right-of-way? Because I've been yelled at by drivers saying they have the right-of-way.
You have the right of way, but as I tell, as I've told students for 30 years, but first of all, I say two things. I say, yes, I'm clergy. I believe in the power of prayer. I just don't want your crossing technique to be praying that you're not going to get hit. The second thing I would say to a student is, you can have the right of way as much as you want. It doesn't matter if the car doesn't stop. You do indeed have the right of way in most states. And again, you have to check your particular state, but pedestrians in every state almost always have the right of way. That doesn't mean you're not going to get hit. Doesn't mean the driver's going to yield, and doesn't reduce your risk at all, because drivers are responding unconsciously most of the time, 95% of the time. So you have the right of way, but you might consider, as you know you're approaching a driveway, of using techniques that are going to alert the driver that you're there, and then they'll stop and hopefully not holler at you. If you want to have an exchange and say, I have the right of way, go right ahead. Best answer I got.
Oh, thank you very much for your answer.
Second question.
Margie, you can unmute.
Hi. First of all, thank you for this very valuable presentation. I just wanted to offer a tip. When I was in high school, my TBI would not allow me to get out of the first part of driver's training, which is teaching you all about, you know, the roads, the safety, et cetera, which really gave me a lot of valuable information as a pedestrian. And of course, when it came down to the actual hands-on behind the wheel, I didn't do that. But that being said, I'm very aware that a lot has changed in the last 40 years. I think it'd be a great value, maybe next year at our convention, to have someone that teaches traffic school to come and do a workshop for us. Thank you.
That wouldn't be a bad idea. There has been indeed many. I wish I had time to talk about it because it's one of my specialties, but talking about how traffic signals have changed and road geometry, et cetera, is a critical. I would say if you compare up a knowledgeable orientation mobility specialist with a traffic school driver, that would be a fantastic thing. I'm really running out of time, so I'm going to give you the last study. Let me share the screen again. That talks about driver yielding at roundabouts. Let me start with, on the screen is a picture of me holding my hand up to a car that is yielding at a roundabout exit. Remember, roundabout exits are places where drivers are driving more quickly, and they're usually entering a long stretch of roadway. Entranceways to roundabouts, they're driving slower, and they have to deal with merging traffic, so they tend to yield much more at entrances. So we looked at drivers leaving exits at roundabouts. I'll tell you this. Oh, let me go through these stats quick. At the entry lane, there was a study with no cane or dog, 20% yielding, with a cane or dog, 36% yielding. At the exit lane, no cane or dog, 0%, with a cane or dog, 9%. So a couple of things. I'm just going to note here, and I don't have a solution to this, and we don't have time to talk about it. Dogs almost always, well, in the three small studies we have in one published piece of research, dogs got substantially less yielding than people with canes. Now, that's one thing to note. And yielding is very bad at roundabouts. I'm about to show you a video, and I'll explain what the video is. I'm standing at a crosswalk at a roundabout exit. There's a long exit roadway coming from the roundabout. There's active traffic, and I'm going to execute a reversible step, and we're going to see what the traffic does. And I'll let you know what the traffic does as the video ends. And it's a very short video. Here we go.
You may need to share audio for that to come through.
I'll talk over it then. I can hear a car coming at me. I step out and do the reversible step, and the two cars that were coming into my crosswalk stop. And that's what it looks like if you have access to the video. And that's basically it. If you couldn't hear the traffic sounds, all you're missing is cars coming at me, and I'm listening for when I can detect the first car to my left. So let's look at what the results of this was at the roundabout entrance. Just really, With a cane display, yielding was 35%. With a cane, with a hand up displayed towards the driver, yielding went up to 100%. With a reversible step, yielding was 100%. So this shows you the impact of what we were taught when we learned how to use a cane, which is just put your cane out there and display it. And then if you do this reversible step or the hand up at this entrance to the roundabout, which has the slower traffic, yielding went from 35% to 100% in our particular study. Moving to the results at the roundabout exit, a cane display got 10% yielding. When we did the hand-up technique, that is the person putting their hand up towards the driver as they get as they decide to cross, yielding went up to 60%. And with a reversible step, yielding went up to 95%. Now, those are pretty dramatic numbers of drivers in this situation where they don't tend to yield much at all, that is exiting exiting a roundabout. And we've got 1 or 2 minutes left, I think, where we might be able to take another question or two. So I'm going to invite a few more questions. And when the hosts have to cut me off, please do.
Okay, area code 650. You can unmute.
What are the last three on that, Belinda?
155.
Oh, I think that's Roger. Roger, you can unmute.
You want to just move on to the next one?
Yeah, sure. Let's go ahead and move on.
Okay. Area code 951, ending in 704. Hang on 1 second. I'm having an issue here. Actually, student 925.
Sorry, I finally unmuted. Oh, my God.
There you
go. I could not unmute.
There
Hi, this is 951. Hi, my name is Nancy. I have a guide dog. That's a terrible statistic about guide dogs. It's crossing. Oh, anyway.
Well, Nancy, remember though, that your dog also does intelligent disobedience. So it's sort of a balance.
Right. Oh, yes, you're absolutely correct. Touche. You said the right thing. I forgot about that. Yeah. This isn't a stupid question. Have you done studies about either talking signals or audible signals, or do they make a difference?
Well, yes. Let me answer that quickly, because it's a great question. First of all, these are called accessible pedestrian signals. That's the official name. That's what everybody should call them. They are all audible, but they are accessible because they're accessible to deafblind people through vibrotactile. And we're not leaving out deafblind people from our accessibility cohort.
Saturday, okay. I'm on the phone.
Second of all, the preferred output for these devices should not be speech, because the speech only helps if you know that Main Street is to your left and Smith Avenue is to your right. The appropriate output is rapid tick. The accessible signals do one thing. They tell you when the walk signal is on. That's all they live for. That's all they do. They don't make a crossing safe. They don't make it risk-free. They just tell you when the walk signal is on. That's what they do. And that gives you several advantages. It lets you cross the street with more than one person, if there is more than one person there. That's a good thing. It lets you cross the street at the beginning of the walk interval. That's when the driver expects you to walk, and that gives you the most time to cross. And thirdly, it puts you it ensures that you're going to get the most yielding because of those factors. So there are many advantages to the pedestrian accessible pedestrian signals, APS, only because you have access to the walk signal, and that walk signal is what you need to cross the street with the least amount of risk. I would also note, though, if you cross with the walk signal, you don't ever have to rush. You do not need countdowns to be spoken out, because all that does is block the traffic sounds that you need to monitor for turning traffic. You are guaranteed, at a very slow pace of walking, enough time to cross if you cross in the walk interval. And the way to cross in the walk interval is having an accessible pedestrian signal present. So all of that says you deserve equal access to that walk interval, and you should advocate for and fight for accessible pedestrian signals, because that's what will make you safest. And if you still have turning traffic to worry about, use the techniques we talked about today. That's a great question. Am I done with time, or are there any more questions? Or neither?
Well, Gene, this is Linda, and my watch says 2:15, which is the instructions that I have to move on to the next presentation. So this has been amazingly informative. I was just riveted throughout. And I'm hoping that you will be able to take a nap and then get yourself some delicious Thai iced coffee to face the day. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I hope I can get back to sleep. It's 4:15 here, it's been a pleasure. I always want to, I love being invited to these things. I just got off a plane, in the morning, yesterday morning. And so whenever I can talk about this stuff, I'm happy to appear. I will be at ACB National.
Excellent.
In July. And I thank you for the opportunity. I thank everybody for the really great questions, and I wish you a wonderful rest of convention.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dean.
Take care.
You too.
Sawadee kap.
That is. I just love it when the Reverend Gene Borquin left. We can't forget that Reverend part. Anyway, I'm going to use my power one more time. Real quick, right, Sarah? We'll do it real quick.
Real quick.
Another door prize.
Okay, real quick. A $25 Amazon gift card donated by Greater Los Angeles. And the winner is Charlene Ornelas.
Ooh. Woohoo, Charlene.